This is Audible.
Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems by Richard Ferber, M.D. Narrated by George K. Wilson. Copyright 1985-2006 by Richard Ferber, M.D. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Fireside, a division of Simon & Schuster, Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Publisher's note: selected figures in this audiobook appear in a printable PDF, which has been included on the first audio and MP3 CD. If you downloaded this audiobook in a digital format, please visit our website at www.tantor.com and type "Solve Your Child's Sleep Problems" into the search box. Follow the link to the book's page, then click on PDF Extra 1. When prompted, enter the access code BEDTIME to access the bonus material. Preface to the Second Edition. When the first edition of this book appeared in 1985, the medical field devoted to the treatment of sleep disorders in children was new. Still, over the years, the basic information I presented on the nature of sleep and sleep problems in children has remained sound, and the techniques I described to help children with sleep problems have proven to be well-conceived and practical. The value of these approaches has been confirmed repeatedly, not only at our Sleep Disorder Center in Boston, but at many others, and by many different professionals around the world. Most of the comments I have received from families who carefully read and then applied the techniques outlined in the first edition have expressed gratitude, with parents thanking me for helping them find a solution to a sleep problem that had been going on for months or years. So why did I see the need 20 years later for this revised and considerably expanded edition? There are three main reasons. The first is to correct some widespread misconceptions regarding my methods and their application. My goals have always been to help parents understand the nature of sleep and of childhood sleep problems, determine the causes of their own child's sleep difficulties, and choose or design an appropriate treatment program that fits their own philosophy of child rearing. I have always believed that the more you understand about your child's sleep problems, the more humane and effective you can be in solving them. A child may cry repeatedly each night, for example, but until parents understand why that is happening and institute proper treatment, they may be unable to resolve it in a way they find satisfactory. Despite my efforts in the first edition to communicate these goals, it became clear that they were not always understood as I had intended. Many people thought I recommended a single method to treat all sleep problems, regardless of the nature of the problems, their causes, or the parenting styles and wishes of the family. Even worse, the particular method they referred to, only one of many approaches described in this book, has sometimes been incorrectly described as the same cry-it-out method that my suggested techniques were meant to counter. Simply leaving a child in a crib to cry for long periods alone until he falls asleep, no matter how long it takes, is not an approach I approve of. On the contrary, many of the approaches I recommend are designed specifically to avoid unnecessary crying. Most of the sleep problems discussed in this book can be corrected without any crying at all, or if the child is already crying at night, by rapidly reducing it. In the one case where some crying may be necessary, when undesirable nightly practices or habits must be changed, crying can be kept to a minimum. In this edition, I have attempted to make it much clearer that there are many different sleep problems, that apparently identical sleep problems may have different causes in different children, and that a single sleep problem may have multiple contributing causes. To properly choose a treatment, one must take all these factors into account. Each problem and cause may require a different treatment. What works well for one problem may be inappropriate for another, and all component causes may have to be treated. A partial solution is no solution at all. In addition, often a number of treatment options are available, some of which fit a particular child's needs or personality and his or her parents' desires better than others. I have tried to present more of these choices so that you, the listener, can find an approach you believe appropriate and are comfortable with, whether you live in a big home or small, sleep separately or together, or have one child or many. And whether your child is nervous or confident, cooperative or difficult, outgoing or shy. The second reason for this new edition is to better address topics that were discussed inadequately in the original. Questions from parents have helped me identify topics that needed to be expanded, such as co-sleeping, naps, sleep problems in twins, and travel to different time zones. The omission of co-sleeping from the original version, apart from a regrettably brief reference that only repeated the conventional attitude of the day, was unfortunate, given the importance of the issue to many parents. This edition covers such topics in the detail they deserve. Finally, in this revision, I have added new information drawn from the last 20 years' experience, study, and scientific discoveries. We now have more accurate information than we did in 1985 about children's sleep requirements, and we know more about the biological clock and its effects on sleep and alertness, about sleep terrors and related problems, and about medical issues such as bedwetting, sleep apnea, and narcolepsy. Through my work with thousands of families, I can now offer a number of new methods for treating a variety of common sleep problems. How to use this book. Sleep problems are rather complex by nature, and to understand and treat them, you need to know a little bit about how sleep works. Although you may be tempted to skip directly to the chapters describing a particular problem of interest to you, I suggest that you begin, regardless of the type of sleep problem you hope to solve, by listening to the 4 general introductory chapters on sleep and sleep rhythms, the 3 chapters in Part 1, and Chapter 9, Schedules and Rhythms, in Part 3. These chapters give you the background information you will need to understand most of what appears in other chapters. You will be best equipped to understand any problem if you also listen to most of the remaining chapters. Many children have more than one sleep problem, and sleep problems are often interconnected. For instance, although the most common cause of sleeplessness in young children, poor sleep associations, is addressed in a single chapter, you may not be able to treat it successfully unless you take into account material from the chapters on limit setting, fears, schedules, or partial wakings. If your child has sleep terrors, you may need to understand the impact of habits and schedules on your child's symptoms before you can help effectively. And you cannot always deal properly with a problem of limit setting unless you also take into account your child's anxiety or an inappropriate bedtime. Some more specific suggestions follow. For a sleepless child, including a child who exhibits sleepwalking, sleep terrors, or head banging, in addition to the introductory chapters, listen to much of the material from Parts 2, 3, and 4 before deciding what the problem is and embarking on a treatment program. At a minimum, listen to Chapters 4 and 5 on sleep associations and limit setting, Chapters 10 and 11 on schedule disorders, and Chapters 13 and 14 on partial wakings and nightmares. If your child is still feeding at night, also listen to Chapter 6. If your child is frightened at night, also listen to Chapter 7. If your child is colicky or has another underlying medical problem, listen to Chapter 8. If your child is still napping or should be but isn't, listen to Chapter 12. If your child rocks or bangs his head at night, listen to Chapter 16. If your child snores, listen to chapter 17. For a child who is sleepy during the day, since sleepiness is most commonly caused by insufficient sleep or an inappropriate schedule, start by listening to the same chapters just suggested for dealing with a sleepless child. In addition, listen to part 5. For a child who wets the bed, focus on chapter 15. For a child whose main problem is snoring, focus on chapter 17. If you base your interventions on the contents of a single chapter and then find that the problems do not resolve quickly, you should stop what you are doing and finish listening to the chapters suggested before you proceed any further. Comment on case histories. As in the first edition, many examples are presented using actual patient histories. Many new ones are included in this edition. Some of the original stories have been retained from the first edition, sometimes with modifications, with some of the names changed to fit contemporary usage. A few of the patients described are composites of several children. However, all descriptions are based on real patients. Richard Ferber, Newton, Massachusetts, 2006. Part 1. Your Child's Sleep. Chapter 1. At the End of Your Rope. The most frequent calls I receive at the Center for Pediatric Sleep Disorders at Children's Hospital, Boston, are from parents whose children are sleeping poorly. When the parent on the phone begins by saying, "I am at the end of my rope," or "We are at our wit's end," I can almost always predict what will be said next. Typically, the couple or single parent has a young child, often their first, who is between 5 months and 4 years old. The child does not fall asleep readily at night, or wakes repeatedly during the night, or both. The parents are tired, frustrated, and often angry. Their own relationship has become tense, and they are wondering whether there is something inherently wrong with their child, and whether they are unfit parents. In most cases, the parents have had lots of advice from friends, relatives, and even their pediatrician on how to handle the situation. "Let him cry. You're just spoiling him," they are told, or, "That's just a phase. Wait until she outgrows it." They don't want to wait, but they are beginning to wonder if they will have to, since despite all their efforts and strategies, the sleep problem persists. Often, the more the parents do to try to solve the problem, the worse it gets. Sooner or later, they ask themselves, "How long do I let my child cry? All night?" And if the child gets up 4, 5, or 6 times a night, will this phase pass before we collapse from exhaustion? Everything seems pretty hopeless at first. If your child isn't sleeping well or has other problems that worry and frustrate you, such as sleep terrors, bedwetting, nightmares, or loud snoring, it won't take long for you to feel as if you're at the end of your rope, too. Let me assure you that there is hope. With almost all of these children, we are able at least to reduce the sleep disturbance significantly, and usually we can eliminate the problem entirely. The information in this book will help you identify the type and cause of your child's particular disturbance, and it will give you a variety of practical ways of solving the problem. When a family visits the sleep center, I meet with the parents and child together and learn all I can about the child's problem. How often does it arise, and how long has it lasted? What are the episodes like? How do the parents handle the child at bedtime and during the nighttime wakings? Is there a family history of sleep problems, and are there social factors that might be contributing to the problem? Given this detailed history, a physical examination, and in certain cases, laboratory study, it is usually possible to identify the disorder and its causes. At that point, I can begin to work with the family to help them solve their child's sleep problem. At the sleep center, our methods of treatment for the sleepless child rarely include medication. Instead, I work with the family to set up new schedules, routines, and ways of handling their child. Often, the child's biological rhythms may need normalizing, or at least his sleep-wake schedule may need to be changed. He may have to learn to associate new conditions with falling asleep, or get used to fewer and fewer nighttime feedings. The family may have to learn how to set appropriate limits on the child's behavior, and the child may need an incentive to cooperate. And any anxiety in the child or parent must be taken into account. I always negotiate the specifics of the plan with the family. It is important that they agree with the approach and feel confident that they will be able to follow through consistently. As much as possible, I offer choices. The best solution frequently differs considerably from family to family and from one culture or social group to another. If the child is old enough, we include him in the negotiations. Thus, we use a consistent and firm but fair technique tailored to the particular sleep problem and to the needs and desires of the child and family. Sleep problems are rarely the result of poor parenting, nor, with a few exceptions, are they part of a normal phase that must be waited and waited and waited out. Finally, there is usually nothing physically or mentally wrong with the child himself. Most parents are immensely reassured to know that sleep problems are common in all types of families and social environments, and that most children with such problems respond well to treatment. In certain cases, such as in sleep apnea, or less often in bedwetting, medical factors may be involved, and our intervention may include medication or surgery. Emotional factors may play a role in other instances, such as in the sleepiness of depression, recurrent nightmares in an anxious child, sleep terrors in the adolescent, and extreme nighttime fears. Here, it is important to identify the source of these feelings and deal with them satisfactorily so the sleep problems can resolve. Sometimes, professional counseling is recommended. How well your child sleeps from the early months affects not only his behavior during the day, but also your feelings about him. I have often heard parents say, "He is such a good baby. We even have to wake him for feedings." Although the parents are really just commenting on the baby's ability to sleep, they may start thinking that their baby is good in the moral sense. It is easy to see how this distinction can influence the way you relate to your child. If your child does not sleep well, he may well be making your life miserable. It isn't hard to think of such a child as a bad baby. You will probably feel enormously frustrated, helpless, worried, and angry if you have to listen to crying every night, get up repeatedly, and lose a great deal of your own much-needed sleep. If your child's sleep disturbance is severe enough, your frustration and fatigue will carry over into your daytime activities, and you are bound to feel increasingly tense with your child, spouse, family, and friends. If this is the case in your home, you will be pleased to learn that your child is almost certainly capable of sleeping much better than he is now, letting you get a good night's sleep yourself. To make that happen, you need to learn how to identify your child's problem. Then you can begin to solve it. The case studies in this book are based on my experience at the sleep center. The discussions of these cases, along with descriptions of the underlying sleep disorders and explanations of the methods of solving them, will help you identify, understand, and deal with your own child's sleep problem. Can a child just be a poor sleeper? Parents often believe that if their child is a restless sleeper or can't seem to settle down at night, it's because he is by nature a poor sleeper, or doesn't need as much sleep as other children of the same age. These beliefs are almost never true. Virtually all children without major medical or neurological disorders have the ability to sleep well. They can go to bed at an appropriate time, fall asleep within minutes, and stay asleep until a reasonable hour in the morning. And while it is normal for a child or an adult to wake briefly a few times during the night, these arousals should last only a few seconds or minutes, and the child should go back to sleep easily on his own. In fact, the mistaken belief that your child is unable to sleep normally can have a strong influence on how his sleep pattern develops from the day you bring him home from the hospital. I have seen many parents who were told by the nurse in the maternity ward, "Your baby hardly sleeps at all. You're in for trouble." Because parents like these are led to believe their child is a poor sleeper, and there isn't anything they can do about it, they allow him to develop poor sleep habits. They don't think it is possible for him to develop good ones. As a result, the whole family suffers terribly. Yet almost all of these children are potentially fine sleepers, and with just a little intervention, they can learn to sleep well. It is true that children differ in their ability to sleep. Some children are excellent sleepers from birth. In the early weeks, they may have to be wakened for feedings. As they grow older, not only do they continue to sleep well, but it becomes difficult to wake them even if one tries. They sleep soundly at night in a variety of situations, bright or dark, quiet or noisy, calm or chaotic. They can tolerate an occasional disruption of their sleep schedules, and they sleep well even during periods of emotional stress. Other children seem inherently more susceptible to having their sleep patterns disrupted. Any change in bedtime routines, an illness, a hospitalization, or the presence of house guests can cause their sleep patterns to worsen. Even when these children have always been considered non-sleepers, we usually find that they too can sleep quite satisfactorily once we have made appropriate changes in their routines, schedules, surroundings, or interactions within the family. Such children may still have occasional nights of poor sleep, but if the new routines are followed consistently, normal patterns will return quickly. There are, of course, children who sleep very poorly for reasons we have as yet been unable to identify. However, these problems are extremely uncommon and account for only a tiny percentage of the children we see with difficulty sleeping. For those few, our usual behavioral treatments may help very little or not at all, and medication may even be required. If your child is up a great deal in the night, it may be tempting to assume that he is one of these genuinely poor sleepers. But that is almost certainly not the case. Such instances of truly poor sleep ability are quite rare among otherwise normal young children. In all probability, your child's sleep problem can be solved. He almost certainly has a normal inherent ability to fall asleep and remain asleep. This is true even if he has a sleep disturbance such as sleepwalking or bedwetting. These problems occurring during sleep or partial waking are sometimes bigger management challenges than is sleeplessness, but with the appropriate intervention, they too can usually be decreased significantly, if not resolved completely. How to tell whether your child has a sleep problem. If your child's sleep patterns cause a problem for you or for him, then he has a sleep problem. Whether this problem is just an undesirable expression of normal function or a reflection of an actual underlying emotional or physical disorder in the sense of a true psychological disturbance or a physiological abnormality of body function. Sometimes it is easy to see that such a problem exists. Other times, sleep problems may be less obvious and easier to miss. It is usually clear that a problem exists, for example, if your child commonly complains that he can't fall asleep, or if you find you must be up with him repeatedly during the night. In fact, the most common problems are easy to recognize. They are frequent difficulty falling asleep at bedtime, waking during the night with an inability to go right back to sleep without parental support or intervention, waking too early or too late in the morning, falling asleep too early or too late in the evening, difficulty getting up for school or daycare, and being excessively sleepy during the day. Sleep terrors, sleepwalking, and bedwetting are also readily apparent and quite easy to identify. Your child could also have a sleep problem that you do not recognize. You may not be able to tell if your child routinely gets too little sleep at night to function normally during the day, or if by sleeping late on weekend mornings he decreases his ability to learn during the week. You and his teacher may think that when he falls asleep every day in school and on the bus, it is because he is bored or unmotivated. In fact, he may not be getting enough sleep. His sleep may be of poor quality, or he may even have a disorder, such as narcolepsy, that leaves him unable to stay awake during the day, no matter how much sleep he gets, and regardless of his motivation. You may see him as lazy or irritable, not recognizing that his behaviors are a reflection of poor sleep or of a sleep disorder. You may know he snores loudly every night, but not realize that the snoring is a sign that he might not be breathing satisfactorily, a problem that can interfere with his sleep and leave him overtired and irritable during the day. It is important to remember that poor sleep affects daytime mood, behavior, and learning. At the same time, you should also know that sleep problems don't explain all daytime problems. If you don't know enough about normal sleep patterns, you may fail to recognize sleep problems as the cause of your child's behavioral or learning difficulties. Or you may be tempted to blame these difficulties on poor sleep, even when your child's sleep is perfectly normal. One of the least obvious problems of sleep is simply not getting enough of it. There is no absolute way to judge from numbers alone whether the amount of sleep your child gets per day is appropriate. Figure 1 in your PDF companion shows the average amount of sleep children get at various ages during the night and at nap times. Most children will fall within about 1 hour of the times on that chart. After the very early months, total sleep time per 24-hour period drops to about 11 or 12 hours, diminishing only very gradually after that. The total amount of sleep differs surprisingly little among children, although the way they choose to distribute it may differ. 1 9-month-old may sleep 9 hours at night and take 2 solid 90-minute naps. Another may sleep close to 12 hours at night and nap only briefly during the day. Children should fall asleep quickly, sleep well at night, wake spontaneously, or at least easily, in the morning, and nap only as appropriate for their age. If they do all these things and function well during the daytime, then they are probably getting enough sleep. If it is always hard to wake them, or if they sleep an extra hour or two on weekends, then they are almost certainly not getting enough sleep. This is especially likely if they also sleep inappropriately, or at least get very sleepy during the day, or if their behavior and ability to concentrate deteriorate markedly, typically in the mid to late afternoon. But each child is different. We can watch a child's behavior during the day closely to see if he seems excessively sleepy or cranky, but the symptoms of insufficient sleep in a young child can be very subtle. If your 2-year-old sleeps only 8 hours a night, but seems happy and functions well during the day, it is tempting to assume he doesn't need more sleep. But 8 hours is rarely enough sleep for a 2-year-old. If you can find out why he sleeps so little and make appropriate changes, he will probably sleep an hour or two longer every night. You may begin to notice an improvement in his general behavior, and only then will you be aware of the more subtle symptoms of inadequate sleep that were actually present before you adjusted his sleep schedule. Your child will probably be happier in the daytime, a bit less irritable, more able to concentrate at play, and less inclined to have tantrums, accidents, and arguments. Adolescents almost never get enough sleep. Teenagers are not likely to wake spontaneously on school days, and they almost always sleep late on weekends, at least 1 hour later than on weekdays, often 3 to 5 hours later. When adolescents have the opportunity to sleep as much as they like every night, they average about 9 to 10 hours per night, and that is probably closer to the optimal level for their age. Nighttime wakings are another potential problem that can be difficult to recognize as abnormal. A young child between 6 months and 3 years old, say, may be getting adequate amounts of sleep at night, even though he wakes several times during the night and has to be helped back to sleep. Parents say to me, "Tell me if this is normal. If it is, I will continue getting up, but if it is not, then we would like to do something about it." I assure them that most healthy, full-term infants are sleeping through the night, which really means that they go back to sleep on their own after normal nighttime wakings by 3 or 4 months of age. Certainly by 6 months, all healthy babies can do so. If your baby does not start sleeping through the night on his own by 5 or 6 months at the latest, or if he begins waking again after weeks or months of sleeping well, then something is interfering with the continuity of his sleep. He should be able to sleep better, and in all likelihood, the disruption can be corrected. Starting with a basic understanding of sleep. Before we begin to discuss specific problems and their solutions, you will need some background information about sleep itself, which is covered in Chapter 2. Although you don't need to be familiar with all the scientific research on sleep, it will be helpful for you to have some understanding of what sleep really is, how normal sleep patterns develop during childhood, and what can go wrong. Then you will be better able to recognize abnormal patterns as they begin to develop, to correct problems that have become established, and to prevent other problems from occurring. Although the information on sleep in Chapter 2 is not overly technical, you may be eager to listen to the later chapters to learn about specific sleep disorders and their treatments. If that is the case, I suggest that you listen quickly to the next chapter first, and then come back to listen to it more closely once you have identified your own child's sleep problem. Most people find the information interesting, and it is especially important for parents who want to help a child sleep better at night. Chapter 2. What We Know About Sleep. Although our knowledge remains incomplete, a great deal has been discovered about what happens in the brain during sleep, what areas of the brain become active or quiescent, how cellular activity changes, and which neurotransmitters, chemicals that carry signals between nerve cells, are released or blocked. Much has also been learned about the so-called biological clock, a small group of cells that keep our sleep-wake cycle running on about a 24-hour rhythm. This clock controls not only sleep, but also variation in just about every other physiological system throughout the day. The cells that constitute it lie in a primitive area of the brain, the hypothalamus, that also controls many other important automatic functions, such as hunger, thirst, temperature, and hormone levels. Nevertheless, we do not fully understand why we need to sleep, what causes us to sleep, and what purposes sleep serves. There can be no single answer to these questions in any case, because how you answer them depends on the level at which you approach sleep and waking. At the most basic level, that of neurophysiology, we can say we sleep and wake because of changes in the brain's chemical environment and in its cellular and electrical activity. On a higher level, that of function and behavior, we can say we sleep because sleep serves a restorative function for our bodies and perhaps our minds. Sleep certainly is necessary for us to function properly during the day. If we don't get enough of it, we feel sleepy, and this feeling can only be relieved by sleep. Finally, from an evolutionary perspective, the purpose of sleep lies in the benefits it provides for our survival. We can say, as various researchers have, that the purpose of sleep is to protect us from nocturnal predators, to rest the body, to maximize our alertness during the day, or to allow us to process memories. If we turn the whole question around and ask, why do we ever stop sleeping and wake up? We could also answer in terms of physiology, because of chemical and electrical changes in the brain, or of function, behavior, and evolution. We need to be awake to eat, procreate, and care for our young. Until the 1950s, doctors and other researchers believed that sleep was a single state, distinguishable only from waking. However, we now know that sleep itself is divided into two distinctly different states, REM, pronounced as a single word, REM, or rapid eye movement, sleep, and non-REM sleep. During non-REM sleep, you lie quietly with a regular heart rate and breathing pattern. It is probably closest to what we usually think of as sleep, and it provides most of sleep's restorative properties. There is very little dreaming in this state, if any, although thought-like processes may continue. In REM sleep, physiological systems are much more active, and it is in this state that we do nearly all of our dreaming. During the night, you cycle back and forth between periods of non-REM and REM sleep, as well as having the usually brief, occasional waking. Non-REM sleep. After the earliest months of life, non-REM sleep divides further into four distinct stages. These stages range progressively from drowsiness to very deep sleep, and they can be identified in the laboratory by monitoring brain waves, eye movements, and muscle tone. As you begin to fall asleep, you enter stage one, the state of drowsiness. Although you are unaware of it, your eyes move about slowly under your closed eyelids. Your awareness of the external world begins to diminish as well. You have no doubt had the experience of becoming drowsy in a lecture or meeting. As you nod off, you miss some of the speaker's comments, yet you will jerk awake instantly if your name is called, or if your head bends so far forward that you are about to fall off the chair. You might think you hadn't been asleep at all if it weren't for your lapse of awareness. On waking from this drowsy state, you might remember some thoughts of the kind usually described as daydreams. Some people report seeing or hearing things more like the true dreams that occur during REM sleep, except that they are shorter, less well-formed, and less bizarre. If you allow yourself to continue the transition through drowsiness toward deeper sleep, you may notice a sudden jerk of your whole body that actually wakes you briefly and interrupts your descent into sleep. This hypnagogic startle is quite normal, although it does not happen every time we fall asleep. Drowsiness really represents a transitional state between wakefulness and the more fully established stages of non-REM sleep. But we can only identify the arrival of the next stages for certain if we monitor the brain's electrical activity, or brain waves. At the onset of stage two, short bursts of very rapid activity, called sleep spindles, and large, slow waves, K-complexes, begin to appear. See figure 2 in the PDF accompanying this audiobook. You can still be awakened easily from this stage, but you may not believe that you had really been asleep, depending on how long you had been in stage 2, how deep into this stage you were at the time of waking, and as always on variations between individuals. As in awaking from stage 1, you would probably not report any odd dream images, but you might describe some thoughts or daydreams. As you fall into still deeper sleep, you enter stage 3 and finally stage 4, similar stages that together can be thought of as your deep sleep. The smaller and faster brain waves of waking and light sleep disappear, replaced predominantly by large, slow delta waves. Your breathing and heart rate become very regular. You may sweat profusely, and you will be very difficult to wake. Someone calling your name will no longer easily rouse you, as they would from stage 2 sleep. Instead, you may be oblivious to the sound. However, if a stimulus is important enough, you will likely wake even from stage 4. Apparently, even in the deepest sleep, our minds can still process some outside information. For example, although it may be difficult to wake you when it is your turn to get up and feed the baby, shouts of fire or a child's screams of pain will rouse you promptly. Yet, even though you will wake in these emergencies, you will initially be confused. You may be aware that you need to take quick action, but you will have trouble clearing the cobwebs from your head so that you can think clearly and sort out what to do. The difficulty one has making the transition from stage 4 sleep to alert waking is very significant in several sleep disorders in children, as you will learn when we discuss sleep terrors, confusional arousals, and sleepwalking. Refer to Chapter 13. In non-REM sleep, your muscles are more relaxed than when you are awake. You are able to move, unlike in REM sleep, as we will see, but you lie still because your brain is not sending movement signals to most of your muscles. Disorders such as sleepwalking and sleep-associated head banging are exceptions to this rule. REM sleep. After one or two periods of non-REM sleep, you cycle into REM sleep, a different state entirely. Breathing and heart rate become irregular. Your reflexes, kidney function, and patterns of hormone release change. Your body's temperature regulation systems are impaired, so you do not sweat or shiver. Males have penile erections in this state. Females undergo clitoral engorgement and an increase in vaginal blood flow. The significance of these genital changes is not known. REM sleep is an active state. Your body uses more oxygen than it does in non-REM sleep, a sign that you are expending more energy. More blood flows to your brain, your brain's temperature increases, and your brain waves become busy again, resembling a mixture of waking and drowsy patterns. The mind now wakes up, but the wakefulness of the dream state is quite unlike that of true waking. You respond mainly to signals originating within your own body instead of those coming from the world about you, and you accept without question the bizarre nature of your dreams. In this state, your muscles have very poor tone, especially in the head and neck, and you become profoundly relaxed. Most nerve impulses that would otherwise pass down the spinal cord and out to the muscles are blocked within the spinal cord, so that not only are your muscles relaxed, but much of your body is effectively paralyzed. Signals to move may still be sent out from your brain, but they do not reach your muscles. Only the muscles controlling eye movements, respiration, and hearing are spared. Because this blockade is not complete, some of the stronger signals still get through to the muscles, causing frequent small twitches of the hands, legs, or face. So, although REM sleep is very active in terms of metabolic and brain function, you remain fairly still. In babies, the blockade of motor impulses is not fully developed. More impulses get through to the muscles than in an older child or adult. As a result, a young infant in REM sleep will jerk, grimace, twitch, kick, and even make sounds. Of course, a newborn cannot get up, walk around, and get into trouble. The inhibitory system and the baby mature together, so that by 6 to 12 months of age, that is, by the time the baby can crawl or walk, most motor impulses are blocked and she stays safely in place. The most striking feature of REM sleep is its characteristic bursts of rapid eye movements. During these bursts, the heart rate, blood pressure, respiratory rate, and blood flow to the brain all increase and fluctuate irregularly. If you are awakened during one of these bursts, you will almost certainly report that you were having a dream, and the length of the dream you describe will correspond roughly to the time you had been in that state. Children as young as 2 have described dreams after such wakings, As for younger children who lack sufficient language to describe dreams, we cannot know for certain that they do dream, or what they dream about. However, since all the other features of REM sleep are in place at birth, it is reasonable to presume that even newborns dream. The first dreams are probably very simple repetitions of daily experiences, sounds, smells, sights. Dreams then become more and more complex as higher brain centers and language develop. We cannot say for sure whether your pattern of eye movements indicates that you were actually watching your dream occur. We suspect that this is partly true, and that at least some of the muscle twitching corresponds to the actions taking place in the dream. Fortunately, because only a few of the signals to move actually reach your muscles, you merely twitch a little now and then, rather than getting up and moving about, dangerously acting out a dream. One thing this tells us is that sleepwalking and sleep terrors do not result from dreams or nightmares. Such complex body movements simply cannot occur during REM sleep. Some researchers believe that REM sleep has important psychological functions. Their research suggests that REM dreaming allows us to process daytime emotional experiences and transfer recent memories into longer-term storage. Such theories remain unproven. Certainly, dreams have emotional significance, but their ultimate importance to the dreamer remains a mystery. REM sleep must serve some purpose, since we all dream every night, even those of us who think we don't. And if we are deprived of REM sleep for several nights in a row, we compensate by getting more REM sleep than usual the next night. Yet when people are deprived of most of their REM sleep for long periods of time, as a side effect of medication, for example, they don't seem to show any major ill effects. Humans cannot be totally deprived of REM sleep, at least not easily. Such studies have been done in animals. Complete elimination of REM sleep led to withering and even death. Waking a person from REM sleep can be easy or difficult, depending on how important the waking stimulus is to her and how involved she is in her dream. So the clock radio may not wake you immediately from a really interesting dream. You may even incorporate something you hear on the radio into your dream. On the other hand, an important stimulus such as a burglar alarm will wake you easily. And unlike someone awakened from stage 4 sleep, you will become alert quickly. To sum up, we seem to live in three distinct states. In the waking state, we are rational and we can take care of ourselves and meet our survival needs. In non-REM sleep, the body rests and restores itself, while the mind rests. And in REM sleep, the mind is again active, but it is not rational and it is disconnected from the body. Major body movements do not take place, even though the brain does send out signals to move. One theory suggests that over the course of evolution, REM sleep developed as an intermediate state between non-REM and waking, in which the mind would wake up before being connected to the body. An animal in non-REM sleep, lying quiet and still except for soft, regular breathing, would be relatively safe from predators. But a sudden waking would leave the animal physically active, yet confused and disoriented, and thus vulnerable to attack. An animal that first switched into REM sleep would become more alert, but with its brain still disconnected from its muscles, it could not make any movement or sound that might alert a predator. Once it was sufficiently alert, the animal could wake fully. The muscle paralysis would disappear, and it could react appropriately to danger. This capacity to check for danger may still be important to humans. We all tend to wake up briefly after an episode of dreaming, and at that moment we are sensitive to anything amiss in our environment, the smell of smoke, footsteps downstairs, or quiet sobbing from the next room. If all seems well, we simply return to sleep, and in the morning we probably won't remember waking up at all. Young children often cannot return to sleep quickly after these normal arousals because something seems wrong to them. In one typical situation, it feels wrong that they are alone in their crib instead of in a parent's arms. This common problem is discussed in detail in Chapter 4. How sleep stages develop in children. Sleep patterns begin to develop in babies even before birth. REM sleep appears in the fetus at about 6 or 7 months gestation, and non-REM sleep follows a month or so later. In the fetus and infant, REM sleep is referred to as active sleep and non-REM as quiet sleep. By the end of the 8th month of gestation, both states are well established. In the newborn, active sleep is easy to identify because the baby twitches and breathes irregularly, and you can see her eyes dart about under her thin eyelids. Sometimes you may also see her smile briefly. In quiet sleep, she breathes deeply and lies very still. Occasionally, you may see fast sucking motions and now and then a sudden body jerk or startle. Quiet sleep is still somewhat different from the non-REM sleep of older children and adults. For one thing, it is undifferentiated. The division into separate, distinguishable stages comes later. The brain waves in quiet sleep show large, slow waves occurring in bursts rather than in a continuous flow. During the 1st month of life, the non-REM brain waves become continuous and startles disappear. By the time a baby is a month old, sleep spindles begin to appear, and over the next month or two we can begin to separate non-REM sleep into lighter and deeper stages. K-complex waves, see Figure 2 in the included PDF, characteristic of mature non-REM sleep, do not appear until a baby is about 6 months old, although precursors appear earlier. REM sleep is the earliest stage to form. Premature babies spend 80% of their sleep time in this state. In full-term infants, it makes up half of their sleep. We do not fully understand why REM sleep is so prominent in the early stages of development. We do know that quiet sleep requires a certain degree of brain maturation, so one would expect to see less of that stage in newborns. In REM sleep, the higher centers of the brain receive stimulation from deeper, more primitive areas. Impulses come up the same sensory pathways that are used for sight and sound, and perhaps touch, smell, and taste. Later on, such stimuli are probably incorporated by the brain into dream imagery. While we can know nothing of infants' dreams, this state might allow the baby's developing brain to receive sensory input, to see and to hear, even before birth. This input might be important to the development of the higher brain centers. We also know that the baby in the uterus makes no breathing motions in non-REM sleep. If respiratory movements were never practiced, the child would be born with no experience at all in using these muscles that are so vital to survival. However, respiratory motions do occur in REM sleep, and it may be that the baby is also practicing other kinds of motor activity. Muscular impulses in a fetus are not blocked as completely as they are in children and adults, so the fetus has some ability to practice actual body movements in REM sleep. Fortunately for the mother, there is still some blockage of motor impulses during REM sleep, or the baby might never be still. It may be, then, that REM sleep is most important in the early months as the fetus and baby develops, and progressively less so with increasing age. In fact, although at birth the full-term baby spends half of her sleep time in the REM state, only 1/3 of her sleep will be REM by age 3. And she will reach the adult level of 25% by later childhood or adolescence. Children's sleep cycles. During a period of sleep, children and adults cycle back and forth between REM and non-REM sleep. Once non-REM sleep has developed four distinct stages, and most of the baby's sleep time has consolidated into a single nighttime sleep period, the sequence of sleep stages settles into a cyclical pattern that remains fairly constant throughout life. It is important to know something about these sleep cycles if you are to understand the development of normal sleep patterns in your child and the nature of any sleep problems that may occur. As a child grows from a newborn to an adolescent, the length of the sleep cycle increases from 50 to 90 minutes. Also, the total amount of REM sleep and the percentage of sleep time spent in REM decrease until they too reach adult values. The total amount of stage 4 non-REM sleep also decreases throughout childhood and adolescence as total sleep decreases, but it continues to account for about a quarter of the child's total sleep. A newborn enters REM sleep immediately after falling asleep. By about 3 months of age, she will enter non-REM first, a pattern that will continue for the rest of her life. Unlike adults, who achieve deep sleep only gradually at the start of the night, young children usually plunge through drowsiness and the lighter stages of non-REM sleep into stage 4 within a few minutes. See Figure 3 in the included PDF. In youngsters, stage 4 is an extremely deep sleep, and waking a child from that stage may be almost impossible. For example, if your child falls into stage 4 sleep at night in the car, you can probably carry her into the house, change her into her pajamas, and put her in bed with only the slightest sign of movement or arousal. Even a child who always seems to wake when put into her crib after being rocked to sleep will remain asleep as long as she is not placed into the crib until she has reached stage 4. And if you wake your child from stage 4 sleep to go to the bathroom, she may do so in a semi-awake state and then return to sleep instantly without any recollection of the arousal in the morning. This partial arousal is very similar to what happens during sleepwalking and sleep terrors. Refer to Chapter 13. A child remains in stage 4 for about an hour or two. After that, she undergoes a brief arousal. This partial waking may last for only a few seconds or up to several minutes. Her brain waves change abruptly, showing a mixture of patterns from deep sleep, light sleep, drowsiness, and waking. She will probably move about, perhaps rubbing her face, chewing, turning over, crying a little, or speaking unintelligibly. She may even open her eyes for a moment with a blank stare, or sit up briefly before returning to sleep. Occasionally and briefly, she may even wake fully before the progression of sleep stages continues. There is actually a spectrum of behaviors that can occur during these arousals. The mild ones just described are quite normal. More dramatic behaviors may also occur at these times, including sleepwalking, sleep terrors, and confused thrashing. These events all occur during partial waking from deep, non-REM sleep, and in all of them, the child shows features of both sleeping and waking at the same time. We will discuss these behaviors at length in later chapters, but for now, remember that they are not stimulated by a dream. As noted previously, true dreams, including nightmares, occur only during the REM state. After the brief arousal, there follows a period of a few minutes resembling drowsiness or perhaps the beginnings of REM sleep. There may actually be a short REM episode at this point, especially in adolescents and adults, but young children tend to skip it. The first REM episode, whenever it appears, tends to be relatively short, 5 to 10 minutes, and not very intense. There are not many eye movements, and the child's breathing and heart rates remain fairly stable. Following this episode of REM, or almost REM, the child enters another cycle of deep, non-REM sleep. In young children, the descent back into stage 4 sleep will probably be quite rapid, although not as rapid as it was in the first cycle. This period of deep sleep lasts between 30 minutes and 2 hours, depending somewhat on the child's age, and the arousal that follows it marks the end of the deep sleep period that characterizes the first third of the night. Thus, in children, the first 3 or 4 hours of the night are spent mainly in very deep sleep, from which the child is not easily roused. Parents are often aware of this fact because the period of lighter sleep that follows, with more frequent wakings, may well begin at about the time they are going to sleep themselves. The arousal that ends the initial 3 or 4 hours of deep sleep will almost certainly be followed by a REM episode lasting 5 to 20 minutes. This period of REM sleep may be interrupted by several brief wakings, each followed by a rapid return to sleep. In babies, REM sleep is particularly unstable, interrupted fairly frequently by brief movements and wakings. However, by the time the baby is around 6 months old, the inhibition of motor activity is more complete, and REM sleep becomes more continuous. The REM episode ends with another brief arousal, and the child moves about, adjusts her position, subconsciously checks to see that everything is normal, then goes back to sleep. This momentary awakening has several functions. Changing position is important for the health of skin, muscles, and joints, and the child can check to see that things are the same as when she went to sleep. It is important to be aware that these wakings occur in all children and adults and are quite normal. Parents often perceive them as abnormal, especially if the child cannot return to sleep afterward because the conditions she associates with falling asleep, such as being rocked or patted, are no longer present. This problem of sleep associations will be discussed more fully in Chapter 4. The middle part of the night, after the first REM episode, begins with another period of non-REM sleep, followed by another arousal, and a longer and more intense REM episode. Throughout this part of the night, usually lasting about 4 hours, the child alternates between progressively longer and more intense periods of REM and relatively light periods of non-REM sleep. It is during these hours of light sleep, particularly at the transitions between REM and non-REM sleep, that wakings are most common. Normally, these wakings are brief, but it is also at these times that problems of sleeplessness tend to be most severe. Even adolescents and adults may notice that they seem to wake more easily in the middle of the night, to use the bathroom perhaps, than they do in the morning when their alarm goes off for the day. Refer to Chapter 9. Some children who are kept in bed too long at night sleep only at the beginning and the end, and this middle period of light sleep becomes one of full waking. Refer to Chapter 11. As morning approaches, children descend once more into fairly deep Stage 4 sleep before the final waking. Thus, the last 1 or 2 hours of the night are often quiet, regardless of what came before. Children who tend to wake for the day directly out of this Stage 4 period may seem to wake unhappy or crying every morning. The crankiness usually lasts only about 10 minutes, and although it may seem worrisome, it is not a cause for concern. Other children who re-enter lighter Stage 2 or REM sleep before waking are more likely to wake in good spirits. There is nothing you can do to change the sleep state out of which a child wakes spontaneously. The very deep sleep that children experience at the end of the night is uncommon at older ages. This isn't because the capacity for such sleep is lost, but because adults rarely sleep long enough to allow it to emerge. An adult who sleeps 11 hours or so, or an adolescent who sleeps late on the weekend, may show the same end-of-the-night deep sleep typical of young children. A need for deep sleep built up during the day presumably explains why there is deep sleep at the start of the night, but it does not explain why there is more deep sleep at the end. The return to deep sleep near morning is an inherent feature of our sleep cycling system, one controlled by our biological clock. Refer to Chapter 9. This overview should give you an idea of what is actually happening to your child during the different stages of sleep during the night. It will also help you decide what state your child is in, based on when she fell asleep and what her sleep behavior is like at a given time. These observations will be important as you try to understand what sort of sleep problem your child has and how to deal with it. Sleep and waking patterns. As you listen to this section, keep in mind that the sleep requirements described are only approximate and are not the same for all children. A newborn baby sleeps about 16 hours a day, but for no more than a few hours at a time. She goes through about 7 sleeping and waking periods, distributed fairly evenly throughout the day and night. These episodes, which vary from 20 minutes to 5 or 6 hours in length, begin with a period of REM sleep, and depending on the length of the sleep time, they show several REM-non-REM cycles. Even when your baby sleeps well for a few hours, you can usually observe brief arousals. In the early weeks, there may seem to be no pattern to the sleep cycle. Shorter and longer periods of sleep and waking are scattered over each 24-hour period and vary from day to day. When the baby is around 3 months old, daytime sleep settles into a 3-nap pattern, with the main naps in the mid-morning and mid-afternoon, and generally a brief nap in the early evening. Naps are further discussed in the following section and in Chapter 12. By the age of 3 or 4 months, your baby still sleeps about 13 hours a day, but now her sleep pattern has consolidated into about 4 or 5 regular and predictable sleep periods, with 2/3 of her sleep occurring at night. By now, there should be a clear and appropriate differentiation between day and night. At this age, most infants have settled, which means they are now sleeping through most of the night, at least from a feeding late at night to one in the early morning. By 6 months, almost all infants have settled, and the periods of continuous nighttime sleep have grown longer. The pattern of settling varies with each child, of course, and your baby's nighttime wakings may diminish very gradually, or she may settle quickly, as if suddenly forgetting the remaining nighttime feedings. Some babies settle very erratically. In any case, at some point between 3 and 6 months, your baby should be sleeping well at night. A typical 6-month-old baby sleeps about 12 or 13 hours total. Nighttime sleep typically lasts about 9 1/4 hours, and as long as 11 hours if daytime naps are short, with only occasional brief wakings. In addition, she will take 2 1-2-hour naps each day, one in mid-morning and a second in the afternoon. The evening nap is usually dropped at around this age. On most schedules, the morning nap will start between 9:30 and 10:30 a.m., and the afternoon nap between 2 and 3 p.m. At 1 year, most children are still sleeping close to 12 hours, with 9 or 10 of these hours occurring at night. Most youngsters give up their morning nap at this point or within a few months. The single nap that remains generally follows lunch and occurs at 12:30 or 1 p.m. between the times where the 2 naps had previously been. At the transition to a single nap schedule, you may see other related changes. Since the child now stays awake for longer stretches, sleep may come more easily both at nap time and at night. This is often particularly noticeable if there were problems before. Also, although the second nap may have been dropped, total sleep time generally does not change. Either the remaining nap or the nighttime sleep lengthens. By age 2, your child should still sleep about 9 to 10 hours a night, with a 1 to 2 hour nap after lunch, about 11 1/2 hours total. She will probably continue her afternoon nap until at least age 3. Some children stop by age 2, and others continue napping up to age 5. The dropping of the final nap is the least predictable of all the developmental changes in napping in the first 5 years. However, most children stop napping somewhere between their third and fourth birthdays. Those who tend to sleep longer at night, perhaps 11 hours, may simply not be able to sleep during the day. A child who develops this sleep pattern too early may not make it through the day functioning well. Cutting back that child's nighttime sleep to 9 or 10 hours may allow the nap to reemerge. Refer to Chapter 12. Some children continue napping when the circumstances are especially conducive to sleep, for example in the car, or at daycare or preschool where there is strong pressure to lie quietly during a prescribed rest period, but refuse to nap at home or on the weekends. From age 3 to adolescence, children need gradually less and less sleep, but the decrease is smaller and far more gradual than was previously thought. Once children are past the toddler age, they rarely nap, and they slowly begin to sleep less at night, dropping from about 11 hours in the preschool years to about 10 hours in pre-adolescence. The years from 5 to 12 years of age are really the most wakeful in a child's life. Children between those ages generally sleep well at night and wake well during the day. The ability to nap in the afternoon is mostly lost, even in siesta cultures. Occasional naps may suggest illness. A child who naps most days, especially in school, may have a sleep disorder, such as narcolepsy. But as discussed in Chapter 18, even narcoleptic children at this age may only nap occasionally. Chronic sleep loss at night can cause napping, but that pattern is unusual in the school-age child. Instead, the more common consequence of insufficient sleep is behavioral change during the day. During the 4 years of puberty, rapid changes occur in the child's body, but the total sleep requirement stays about the same. Children aged 14 to 17 still need at least 9 hours of sleep for optimal functioning.